This is a new format of panel that Greenbelt is having this year, whereby, as you can tell, we've got some extremely weighty speakers who've all been given a very... that's a good start. I mean in the academic way. Who are all being given far too short a time to speak as it is. But what we're going to try and do here is draw out more information about Palestine. The session is entitled Palestine is Still the Issue. We are assuming a level of knowledge about what is happening in Israel and Palestine from the audience, partly because Greenbelt has got lots of other things going on. These people are speaking elsewhere. There will be other opportunities to find out basic facts. There are resources as well around the site. So what we're wanting to do now is look at the conflict from different angles. And we have hopefully four. At the moment, three are here. So if the fourth doesn't come, we'll just have three. Witnesses is what we're calling them, people who will give their view of something about the heart of the conflict, and the panel will question them about that and will sum up at the end. I should introduce myself. My name is Sue Plater. I've been involved for many years with campaigning for Palestine, and I'm currently treasurer of Palestine Solidarity Campaign. I'm sure that you recognise the panel from other sessions they've done or from their work, but I will just briefly introduce each of them. To my left is Claire Short, who was the first Secretary of State for International Development when it was set up as a full, it's not a ministry, is it? It's a department, thank you, when the Blair government was elected in 1997. And she has been involved in finding out about Palestine and understanding it and explaining to people why it's at the heart of what's been going on in the Middle East. And she's been acting on that ever since her involvement, and very much involving understanding that development and foreign policy go side by side, and that is now at the heart of development policy with the current government and with the previous government. Ilan Pape is an academic historian who has written about the roots of the state of Israel in 1948 and beyond. And he currently is based in Exeter. He is actually an Israeli but lives over here. Ben White is a journalist and activist. He's leading on a campaign called Just Peace for Palestine, about which you will find information at the festival. And our first witness is Jonathan Kutab, who is a Palestinian Christian, a lawyer, and someone who's been involved in peace negotiations. And he's going to kick us off and give us his viewpoint, a viewpoint on the conflict, and then I will invite the panel to ask him questions. The initial statement by the witnesses will be short, but the idea is that information's drawn out by the questions. And we hope that we will learn more, and the panel will give us some reflections at the end. Jonathan.
Thank you. Since I was given a very brief time, I don't know that I'll be able to say something that's very informative, but I'll make sure at least it is provocative. And I will start by saying that although things do not look optimistic at all, and even though I myself am not optimistic, I am full of hope. As we as Christians distinguish between hope and optimism. Optimism are those who think that the talks about to start are going to result in a breakthrough, or that Obama will change radically U.S. policy and start pressuring Israel. I'm not optimistic, but I am full of hope. Hope as a spiritual quality is founded in the belief that the world that God has created is such that evil and injustice cannot prevail forever. and that there are long-term historical forces that are operating, which will lead in the right direction. So that I propose to you that even though there is a huge vacuum in leadership among Palestinians, Israelis, and Americans, not to mention Europeans, nonetheless, there are forces at play. There are signs that there are changes coming, which I think will surprise people when they come. I will try and tick off a number of what I would consider signs of hope. One of them, paradoxically, is the level of Israeli arrogance, which is totally unprecedented, and their clear willingness to ignore the rest of the world, international law, even their own stated values and beliefs, in utter and complete reliance on military power and force, which again and again we know to be ultimately ineffective. There are changes within Israeli society that are little known to the outside world, which continues to see a certain facade that shows an increasing breakdown in some of the basic institutions which used to give Israel a lot of power and ability to confront effectively and impose its will on its surrounding. And I don't mean just military power. I mean internal institutions that are no longer functioning the way they used to. Another sign of hope is what is happening within the Palestinian community, with a great turning towards nonviolent resistance and building institutions and a disillusionment with armed struggle, which has never really been practiced except rhetorically by the Palestinian community. Now there is a realization that violence does not, in fact, get us where we want. There are changes within the American and expatriate Jewish community, with greater disillusionment with the State of Israel and its policy, and with the settlement movement, and with the positions of the Israeli government, which have become very, very right-wing and totally uncomfortable to Jewish individuals who have a moral and ethical basis to their life and existence, which they can no longer square with unquestioning support for the State of Israel. There have been changes among the evangelical Christian community, which used to give carte blanche through Christian Zionism to all the extreme policies of the State of Israel. Now we have theologians as well as lay people who are conservative Christians who no longer accept positions that they feel are unethical and that they cannot reconcile with the requirements of justice and with love for Jewish Israelis as well as Palestinian Arabs.
Jonathan, can I wind you up so that you can get questions?
Okay, and I think with this my time is up.
Who would like to go first? Yes, Claire.
Jonathan, I agree with you, and I think people do broadly. Since, say, the attack on Gaza, it's quite clear that Israel's position is unsustainable. And in that sense, there's hope that in the end, justice will prevail. But don't you agree that the interim could be a long time, could be very bloody, could lead to lots of human suffering, massive disruption in the Middle East, bitter divisions in the world, that we should live with hope, but we all have a duty to speed up the just resolution, because in the meantime, there could be terrible suffering and violence and bitter division in the world.
Yes, I would agree. There is certainly a lot of suffering right now. And the changes, when they come, they are going to be radical. They are not going to be face-saving. I think they are going to be cataclysmic, whether they're going to be violent or non-violent, whether it's going to be like Ceausescu in Romania or like apartheid in South Africa. We don't know. A lot of it depends on us and on the players in the area. But the present status quo is unsustainable.
I will continue Claire's point. Can you hear me? No, that's fine. Okay. I think there are three, you're right, the three elements of change. One is in the international community, one is in the Palestinian political scene, and one is inside Israel. However, I think there are three different paces to the change. And the slowest is probably the Israeli one. And that, if you do fine-tuning to what you said, this actually should lead us to rethinking about how to formulate the strategy as activists, as politicians, as people who care. Because if all the three transformations were taking place at the same pace, then hope was very important. But because we know that the Israeli transformation is very slow,
it's going backwards.
Almost backwards, exactly, something has to change in the attitude not only of the civil society, but also of the governments. And in this respect, I want to ask you a more specific question. When I and others became involved in the idea of boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel, the PA was very hesitant about this. Can you illuminate and expand a little bit about how do you think the Palestinian leadership today feels about what seems to be the main campaign of people over here to try and show solidarity with the Palestinian people?
Yeah. I think that the change is going to come despite the leaders, whether it's Israeli or Palestinian or American for that matter. I think that part of my hope comes from the collapse of the false peace. As long as there were a peace process, peace negotiation, peace this, peace that, everybody did nothing, because there was the appearance of progress when in fact what was happening was the continuation of injustice. Now when that collapses, now when people stop believing in the peace process and they start asking the hard questions and the radical questions, then change becomes possible. The Palestinian leadership, unfortunately, is too weak to say no, either to the U.S. or to Israel. Abbas is going to the negotiations knowing full well that he only loses by going, but he is too weak to say no.
Is this okay? I wanted to pick up on the issue of non-violence as a method of resistance practiced by the Palestinians. I know you're connected well with a group called Holy Land Trust in Bethlehem. And there's a lot of misconceptions that people have about this issue, certainly in the West. Particularly, there's this misleading question asked, you know, where is the Palestinian Gandhi or where is the Palestinian, etc.? And the answer is that many of them are in prison. But I wanted to maybe ask you to expand on what are particular examples of the way in which this is expanding, because the issue of Palestinian nonviolent resistance doesn't just mean going on a march or doing a sit-down protest by the wall. actually encompasses a lot of things, maybe, for example, non-cooperation and these kinds of issues?
I think the Palestinian problem with nonviolence has not been lack of practicing nonviolence. It has been lack of a unified narrative of nonviolence. We continue to speak the rhetoric of armed struggle while actually practicing nonviolence. What we see now is that major political actors, including people who used to participate in the armed struggle, are now openly saying, we realize we were wrong. We realize Mubarak Awad, who was deported by the Israelis during the first Intifada, precisely for advocating nonviolence, he was right all along. I have people from the security services, Palestinians, coming to me and saying, Mubarak Awad had it right all along. We now have young leaders from Fatah and even from Hamas studying in depth how to use nonviolence as a method of resisting the occupation. We now have campaigns for boycotting the products of settlements in the West Bank. And you must understand that the West Bankers don't have many alternatives to Israeli goods, but they are now first targeting the products of the settlements. And this is all the way to the top, up to the Prime Minister and Salam Fayyad. They are all in favor of this campaign. But most importantly, among the regular cadres of Fatah and some of the leadership of Hamas, there is an ongoing discussion about how we can best use these methods of nonviolence. I'm proud that Holy Land Trust is very involved in that leadership training. But it's not just Holy Land Trust, and it's not just Christians, and it's not just pacifists like myself. It's ordinary Palestinians who now see the beauty, the power, and the effectiveness. And the flotilla, the peace flotilla, with the Turkish forces, with the Turkish boats, I think has shown Palestinians that these 9 martyrs and few hundred volunteers have succeeded, not entirely, but in a large measure, in breaking the siege of Gaza in a way that no number of stupid Qassam rockets could ever dream of succeeding. And it is still ongoing, and people want to build on that experience.
Just before we lose you, we're here in the UK,
yes,
with concerned people who live in the UK. You quite rightly have talked about changing views and forms of resistance amongst Palestinians, but the UK has both a historical responsibility and in recent years has supported more and more outrageous behaviour and breaches of it. So what do you say to us living in the UK that we can do to help speed up the just solution?
Well, I'll repeat what I said earlier. There is a huge gap between the behavior of the political leadership in the UK and the effective behavior of the civil society and the community of people like yourselves. I don't expect the UK government to change its policy anytime soon, or its slavish reliance on the Americans and willingness to push their agenda. But I do expect, and in fact I see, people in the UK really influencing these policies through boycotts, through divestment, and through sanctions. As I mentioned earlier, the one country where Israeli officials, and particularly army officers and generals, are afraid to visit is the UK. Not because the government is not supportive, but because they know that there are people like you who are preparing briefs against the war criminals and those who have committed crimes against humanity in Gaza and elsewhere, that they can face arrest in this country. So they're steering clear of you. This is an example of ordinary people effectively doing what their governments are not willing to do.
Jonathan, thank you very much indeed. And thank you especially. Thank you especially because you stood in for Sami Awad, who unfortunately wasn't able to come at very short notice. And so we do appreciate very much your contribution. And we're going to ask you to not fall off the stage, to go gently that way. And Brian Klug, if you would come this way and replace him in the hot seat. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Brian Klug, who is an academic and an author. He's spoken once today, I think, already, and his book that is about to come out is called Being Jewish and Doing Justice. And I believe that that is an aspect that he's going to use to describe to us what he thinks of the heart of the conflict.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here today. Having also been given just 2 minutes to make a statement.
Five.
It was two in my... two in the written instructions that I received. So I reverted to paper, and I've written something out that I'll read that's fairly brief, and then I'd be very happy to be interrogated about it. And like Jonathan, I will try to be a bit provocative. My testimony comprises two main points. The first concerns the proposition, Palestine is still the issue. I think it's better to say the conflict is still the issue. For one thing, it's more accurate, and for another, it avoids seeming to frame the issue from the point of view of one party to the conflict rather than the other. Naming the issue Palestine is more likely to exacerbate tensions than to contribute to resolving the conflict, especially since it's a conflict where names often mean more than what they signify. Vocabulary matters. Now, this isn't to imply that the two parties, let's call them Israel and Palestine, are equal in all respects, or even in any. Between a state and the stateless, between occupier and occupied, there is no equal contest. On the other hand, it doesn't follow from this inequality that the conflict boils down to this: Palestine good, Israel bad. From the start, going back to the late 19th century, the picture was complicated by the fact that Zionism is intrinsically double-sided. Like the Greek god Janus, it has two faces that look in opposing directions at once. Now, I realize this remark is enigmatic, and if the panel would like me to draw me out on it, I shall be happy to explain what I mean by that and why it matters. My second main point is that alongside the conflict on the ground in the Middle East, there is another battle being waged, one to which Jonathan alluded at one point, a battle over Judaism among Jews around the world. For the position of Judaism today, as I see it, is this. There are two principles that are competing for primacy. One is the principle of unconditional support for the state of Israel, and the other is the principle of unconditional commitment to justice. Nothing exemplifies this battle more clearly than the reaction within the Jewish world to the Goldstone Report, the UN fact-finding mission into the Operation Cast Lead in Gaza that was chaired by Judge Richard Goldstone. Judaism cannot have both these principles at its heart, and the battle between them, unconditional commitment to justice on the one hand and unconditional support to the State of Israel on the other, is as fierce and as fateful for the future as the conflict itself. And again, I shall gladly elaborate if the panel would like me to do so.
Thank you, and thank you for keeping that initial statement brief, which we did ask for in the written instructions. It just gives more time for questions.
Sure.
Overall, we each have the same time. Right. So who would like to start this time?
Brian, do you agree with, so many critics, but it includes even former Prime Minister Olmert and Minister Barak, that the route that Israel is on is likely to destroy the existence of a Jewish state, and that we are getting beyond the point when two states is possible if the settlements continue to expand. And therefore, the critics who are trying to support BDS are really friends of Israel in trying to restrain a hubristic, oppressive behavior which is wrong for others, but also is damaging to both Israel's moral core, that argument of yours, but also its long-term existence as a state.
Well, that's a very interesting set of statements. And since you put it to me in the form of asking for my own take on it, let me say that the way this is very complex and it'll be difficult to say something which covers all the points that you raised there. But let me say that from where I'm sitting, I think it's time to go back to basics. So speaking in my own voice, when you ask me the question about Israel continuing to exist as a Jewish state, in my view, it's time for Israel to move on and no longer to think of itself in terms of the founding ideology. There were reasons why Israel was founded as a Jewish state, and it's part of what I'm getting at when I describe Zionism as double-sided, because on the one hand, it saw itself as a movement for the self-determination of the Jewish people, given the persecution that Jews had suffered over centuries, but especially in the 20th century, actually, in the first half. This was an understandable movement. Not all Jews went along with it, but it was an understandable thing. But on the other hand, it was the other side of it is that it was a movement of European expansion into the Middle East. And this double-sidedness was a tragic quality, as I see it, of events at the time. But that was 1930s, 1940s. We now live in the almost the second decade of the 21st century, and I think it's time to move on. And for Israel to cease to keep its connection to that founding idea, and instead to think of itself as its own state, as belonging not to the Jewish people, but to the Israeli people. I think that would be a step that has to be taken, whatever the eventual constitutional arrangements that are established within the region. It's time to stop defining the state along ethno-religious lines, in my view. But we've a long way to go, I think, before that becomes a consensus within the Jewish world.
And do you think that will come through one state or through Israel itself changing?
A very interesting development has taken place recently, about which I suspect Ilan knows far more than I do. And that is that the idea of one state has suddenly become adopted by sections of the right wing in Israel. Now, admittedly, it's a version of the one state that probably a number of us would find fault with. But nonetheless, there was a time when to even utter the phrase one state was to invite accusations of wanting to destroy Israel. And that language of destruction, by the way, is something I'd be happy to come back to, because I think it's a very important point in the whole public debate, why it is that this idea of being destroyed seems to leap to the mind so often whenever people propose changes in constitutional arrangements applying to Israel or to states that could come into existence in that region. So the one state idea, a version of it, has now been adopted by a section of the right, including the settler right in the occupied territories, as a way of holding on to the notion of a Jewish state. I'm left wondering what the best way forward is. And people talk about a solution, and the argument in the past has always been one state versus two state. I think that debate is now dead in the water. And partly because I don't even know quite what it means to talk about a solution. I think the question is, what is the next step to get us out of the current impasse? And I still cling to the view, though tenuously, that probably some version of another state alongside the existing state of Israel is the next best step towards a future where I hope there would be one state, which would not be defined along ethno-religious lines, but would simply belong to all its citizens. But I consider that to be an open question that people of goodwill can disagree about, and that this development on the right in Israel, funnily enough, has helped to open up the debate.
Yeah, I'll be provocative. It's this mic, not me. I have a strong voice.
Is this better?
Yeah. Yes, that's what I told you.
Clever.
She thought I didn't eat breakfast, and that's why I couldn't.
Now you're going to eat me.
Now I can shout at Brian. No.
It's much better. Be more provocative like this. Brian, I think Palestine is still the issue, not Israel. I would really like, I'm not the organizer, and I haven't come up with a name, and it wasn't my idea, but I really think it's time for a paradigm shift, and I think you should join us in this paradigm shift. And the paradigm shift is that we are concerned about the Palestinians, not about the Israelis, because the Israelis were the main concern ever since the emergence of Zionism. Nobody cared about the Palestinians. When in 1947 the United Nations wanted to create a colonialist state next to the indigenous state, it did something that it knew that no other indigenous national movement in the world would ever accept, which is partition your homeland with a colonialist project. And the world, and especially Europe, forced the Palestinians to accept the partitioning of their homeland and allow a colonialist ethnic racist state to be created next to them. And the result of that decision was the 1967 war, when the rest of Palestine became occupied by Israel. And the result of that decision is still today that the ethnic cleansing of Palestine and the destruction of Palestine continues regardless of Annapolis, Camp David, or whatever other histrionics are being played either on the White House lawn or elsewhere. And I think that you are right. In this, I agree with you, Brian, that one of the major things for the future is to think about even a stronger divorce between Judaism and Zionism. And therefore, I beg you as an Israeli, I beg you, an Anglo-Jew, don't care about me. Don't feel responsible for the fate of the Jews in Palestine. If you'll do that, believe me, this would be the most significant step towards peace and reconciliation in Israel and Palestine. Thank you.
I have a feeling that if you didn't have breakfast, Ilan, you've just eaten me for breakfast.
Sorry if it sounded like this.
Not at all. No, I appreciate it. In fact, I value this because I regard this as very much part of our shared tradition, actually, to have frank and bold direct argument based on mutual respect, but above all based on a pursuit of the truth and understanding. So let me, in the same spirit, reply, but not necessarily in quite the same with quite the same strength of voice. But I, first of all, am struck by the last thing you said when you turned to me and said, please don't care for me as an Israeli, as it were, speaking to me as a Jew. I had supper earlier this week with an Israeli Jewish friend of mine, with whom we talked about this question of identity. And his reaction to my little book, Offense, the Jewish Case, that came out last year, was he read it this way. He said, what you're really doing is claiming a Jewish identity independently of Israel, instead of putting Israel at the center of it. And he said, vice versa, he said, I am an Israeli and not a Jew. And he didn't really mean to disown his Jewishness, but only to make that separation. So there's an agreement here that this separation needs to take place for everyone's sake, for the sake of Israel, for the sake of Jews and for Judaism. Nonetheless, the fact of the matter is that many Jews around the world still do put Israel, if not at the center, nonetheless very close to that, of their own identity as Jews, for reasons that are understandable in terms of Jewish history. And that's what I was trying to get at in my testimony. These are not people who are Western colonialists or imperialists. And very often they're people who would be, say that, who would be opposed to colonialism elsewhere in the world, who are liberally, if not, who are inclined not only to be liberal, but even to be left-wing, even socialist, and so on. But when it comes to Israel, they read it differently. And that's what I meant by saying that Zionism is double-sided. It has two different meanings, two different valences at the same time. It has the one that you have just emphasized, and you do so eloquently in your work. And by the way, I used your work on a course I taught at Southampton last year, and I thank you very much, because it's excellent work. But it also has this other meaning. The Institute for Jewish Policy Research just conducted a survey into attitudes amongst Jews in the United Kingdom, and they just published their findings, and they show that something like 80% of Jews in Britain say that Israel is either of central importance, is either central or important to their identity as Jews. Given that that's the case, I think that to proceed on the basis that we should no longer care about Israel, but only about Palestinians, is not going to promote one of the developments that Jonathan referred to, which is that within the wider Jewish world outside Israel, there are now these cracks that have opened up. And these initiatives, like the one called Independent Jewish Voices, of which I was a co-founder, but there are many others in other parts of the world, which are attracting individuals who identify as Jews, who in that connection feel a very strong closeness to Israel, but who repudiate the direction that Israel has taken, who are totally opposed to the occupation, etc., etc. And so that's my response.
I quite like Ilan and Brian to carry on talking, but I was actually going to make a response to your initial beginning about a critique of the Palestine sort of issue. One of them was going to be a negative response to that, but I think I'll probably all leave that now. And the other one was going to be, in a sense, a more positive response, which is to say that I think maybe a number of us here would want to express the idea that a just, long-lasting peace there is going to be good both for individual Israelis, for the Jewish people who live there, as well as for the Palestinians. So in that sense, it's going to have to be a shared space, is the way in which I respond to that. And I'm glad you brought it back to the UK at the end in terms of talk about British Jewish opinion. And I was wondering maybe if you could expand on the voices that exist here within the British Jewish community that actually do understand the way in which it has to be a shared space, not in a kind of wishy-washy liberal sense, but in a very kind of direct, this is not what is happening now, and we need to take action to get there. And maybe if you could kind of tie into that the way in which that's obviously not a majority opinion at the moment, and the representative bodies don't express that in the way they engage with the wider community. Yeah. Because again, bringing it back to here, and the fact that many people here are probably going to be perhaps connected to a church or to a faith community of some kind. Mm. This can often come up in interfaith issues. And I was wondering whether you could maybe comment a bit on that and draw out the way in which there isn't a monolithic Jewish opinion, but it's certainly a minority dissenting opinion. And how do kind of Christians deal with that here in the UK?
Well, right. Indeed, how do Jews deal with that in the UK, which is my more immediate concern. The way in which some of us dealt with it, let me start that way, a few years ago, was to found this initiative, Independent Jewish Voices, which is a network of individual Jews who agreed on certain general principles, principles of social justice and human rights, principles that, to go back to your point about a shared space, that Israelis and Palestinians have equal priority for the future, instead of favoring one side on the basis of group membership. And that was what we wanted to speak against when we founded Independent Jewish Voices under the heading A Time to Speak Out. What we found, Ben, was that quite a number of fellow Jews were, as it were, in the closet on this. And that when we launched, they came out of the closet and they approached us and said, I've been thinking this, I've been feeling this for so long and so on, but I've not had anywhere to be able to take this, precisely for the reason you gave, which is that on the whole, the bodies that represent the sort of mainstream in the community, bodies like the Board of Deputies of British Jews and so on, and the Chief Rabbinate itself, have either claimed to speak on behalf of all Jews or they've been perceived that way, and they have tended in the past to stand behind the Israeli government, whatever that government does. So what we wanted to do was to break up basically that block and to say, look, we're Jewish, we don't all think alike, actually, and we all know that, and everyone says that in private, then why aren't we saying it in public? Let's speak out and try and normalize this debate. Actually, one of the ironies of this whole tragic conflict is that when Zionism came into existence, it was with a view to normalizing the position of Jews in the world. Now we have a state of affairs where this debate is treated in an abnormal way by many people in the Jewish world, treated as something to be kept secret or private. And we came out and said, no, we want to be just simply out there in the world stating our views. On the one hand, there were those who condemned us. One famous journalist coined the phrase Jews for genocide to describe the signatories to the Independent Jewish Voices statement. But on the other hand, there were, as I say, those who came out of the closet and said, we agree. Some of those, by the way, were people who identify as Zionist, others as anti-Zionist, others neither one way nor the other. But everyone shared the view that Israelis and Palestinians have equal priority when it comes to the future, and we must worry about them in the same breath, in the same thought. That brings me to the question you really were putting to me, which is how to, sorry, am I going on too long? Okay, how to take this, as it were, to, specifically you said, the Christian world.
Within the interfaith context.
Within the interfaith context. It seems to me that the whole issue there has suffered from the grip of fear in a similar way. People are afraid to tread on other people's corns. They're afraid that they will seem to be anti-Semitic or seem to be hostile to the Jewish future. But it's the same problem in a way. It's just like those of us who are Jewish, because as soon as we spoke out, there were those who accused us of being traitors and self-haters and so on, and not really Jewish.
Genocidal. That was another
charge, sorry?
And genocidal.
And genocidal, right. But then over the next few years, that polemic began to die down. So my response to you is to say, call the bluff. But in order to call the bluff successfully and intelligently, in order to break the grip of this fear, which after all is not entirely irrational, it's a fear that is the product of a terrible history. If it wasn't for what happened in the 1940s, when two-thirds of Europe's Jewish population was massacred by the Nazi regime, we wouldn't still be living with this problem, but people are understandably sensitive about it, whether they are Jewish or not. And so I would say call the bluff, but call it intelligently, by showing an understanding of that sensitivity. And I think that sometimes the problem, if I may say so, and perhaps it's being provocative again, is that in talking about Zionism, the Jewish story is folded into the larger Western narrative of imperialism and colonialism, whereas there is that other side, and that's why I wanted to make that the first ingredient in my testimony. The other side of that movement is that it's part of the Jewish story, and that is a story in its own right. And I think that if that understanding can be expressed, then the bluff can be called, and why not be outspoken in the name of justice and human rights and peace and security for everyone in the region sharing a common space?
Brian, thank you very much indeed. Sweet. Could we come? Yes. We're now welcoming Dr. Sui Ang, who is a surgeon now based in London. She worked for many years in Gaza and was in Lebanon in the early 80s, in 1982, at the time of the massacres in Sabra and Shatila camps. Sui Ang, again, a few minutes to give a point of view and then questions.
I think I'm going to upset quite a few people because I've spent 33 years only knowing the Jewish and Israeli perspective. That was all. The beginning and the end is Israel. And then I went to Lebanon when the war became too hot. I think it's a special calling from God. And I ended up in the refugee camps working, met the first Palestinian and heard their story. And there was ifs and buts, like this kind of two sides, you know, on the one hand, on the other hand, on the third hand, on the fourth hand. And 3 weeks later, after the Palestinians evacuated 14,000 members of the PLO, fighters, able-bodied men, in came Israel's army, surrounded the camp, sent in their allies, and massacred 3,000 unarmed people. On the morning of September 1982, when I walked down that Rue Sabra and realized that those few dozen people I operated on and whose lives I've saved were just a small portion of those that were murdered. And I realized that that kind of crime, of that kind of enormity, is not open to debate. Last year, I went to Gaza immediately after Operation Cast Lead. The newspapers and the television and the radios are playing the blame game. And meanwhile, half of Gaza, 21,000 homes, 1,500 people, 5,000 wounded, 1,500 dead. Gaza demolished, under siege, starved for 3 years. And we are talking about a balanced view. Now that cannot go on. I'm very happy to be here. Because I want to talk to people who has got a heart, who cares. I am not an academician. I came back, I operate, I earn my living on NHS as a surgeon. The charity we helped to found is called Medical Aid for Palestinians. For Palestinians. And we want justice. Justice for the Palestinians. And because there will be justice for the Palestinians, there will also be security for the Israelis. But there cannot be security and defense of the Israeli point of view without addressing justice for the Palestinian people. I've done this for 28 years. I'm not going to change.
Read her book, everyone. It's a beautiful book. It's the testimony for what happened in Sabra and Shatila. It's a very readable, very moving, very powerful testimony. I want to ask you really, from that time and those utterly shocking events that you witnessed and you weren't prepared for, and your commitment, therefore, to justice for Palestinians, to now, for you to reflect on the change that's taken place. I mean, it seems to me more and more people in the world know it's wrong, want to make a stand. Our governments are locked in to supporting injustice, but I think as people across the world are moving, I just think because you've lived so intensely with it since then, I'd like you to tell us how you think opinion is changing, whether it makes you hopeful, what you want people to do to speed up that change.
First of all, I want to tell you, do not despair. And do not give in to anger and bitterness. Okay? For those of us who are Christians or Jews or Muslims, you believe in God. And there's justice. We have to keep focus for the sake, not only of the Palestinians, but also of Israelis, that you will not give up hope. Now, I will tell you personally what I experienced. When I came out of the massacre, of course I was bewildered, I was angry, and so I went to Israel, testified before the Khan Commission to talk about the Palestinians. Sharon was found unfit for government, then he became Prime Minister. If you look at that kind of view, you really feel angry, okay? And you get upset. What's the point of fighting? But that's not one view you look. But you look around. This green belt is called looking sideways. Okay, so don't look at what America is doing, the neocons are doing. You don't want to look at what the IDF and the phosphorus and so on. You want to look at yourself, look at your friends, those of you that are here. You look at the Palestinian youngsters who are not afraid, who is growing up. And then they are learning also. They're learning, like Jonathan say, that they are not going to shoot Israel down. They believe in nonviolence, not because they are cowards, not because they are weak, but because it takes a lot more from you not to repay evil with evil. And if you look at this venue here, 28 years ago, I won't be here. And I won't be asked to talk because I'm so one-sided. And 28 years ago, you won't have these boats for Gaza, the flotilla. You don't have young people grow up prepared to stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people to the extent that, you know what happened after 9 people were killed in the flotilla? The number of volunteers to go on the next few flotilla has quadrupled. Got no money to pay for them to go. So death does not frighten them. So this is the ultimate sacrifice that they're prepared to pay. Okay, so we have friends. We have a bigger and bigger network of friends. Of course, the violence is even higher. If you look at what Israel is doing, if you look at the support from the US right wing, because now we are so polarized. The world knows about what Israel is doing. Everybody knows about the injustice. Everybody knows about 181-194-242. We know that the Palestinians, even if we restore and let Palestinians have the land, there's only 13% of Palestinians in the two-state solution. So what on earth is that all about? So this is known. So therefore, force is being used to shut people up, to intimidate people. When I wrote about the wound of Gaza, boy, I tell you, 200 nasty emails. I've never had that before. So that shows we are successful. That shows we matter. And for those of you who actually go out of the way to support the Palestinians, to go and demonstrate in the supermarket and don't buy Israeli products, and you'll be vilified. You are effective and you are successful. Carry on. Because this is the essence of nonviolent struggle. And I thought that one further step we can take is not to pay taxes. But on the other hand, all of us are so poor that we work for a living and our taxes got taken off at source. I've been trying to negotiate with my hospital and they thought we're crazy. You don't want to do PAYE, what are you trying to do, you see? But it matters. So don't give up hope. Carry on. We make a difference.
This one?
Sure.
Yeah. I will ask you a question to which I have an answer.
Okay.
Which I'm not sure is good enough. Okay. I think it's good. I believe in it.
Okay.
And I'm collecting answers to this question. Okay. Because many Israelis feel this is the last barrier. Mm-hmm. And I think if we'll answer properly that question I'm going to ask you,
okay,
we will advance even more,
okay,
towards changing the dismal reality on the ground. And that question is why a person who is not Jewish, mm-hmm, is not a Palestinian, would devote so much of his or her energy and time in a world which has so many other catastrophes, where there is genocide in Darfur, where there are people starving in Africa, and I don't have to give you all the list. This, in terms of numbers of people killed, in terms of the kinds of realities we see on the ground, this world is a terrible place. Mm-hmm. And definitely you can understand why certain groups of people would say, this is my concern and not others. I think your personal story brings a very good question, why Palestine at the center? And I think the Israeli Zionist answer is usually a very suspicious one, mm-hmm, as you know. And I think we have to defeat this suspicion. And as I say, I have my own answer to this, but I'm very, very intrigued to hear yours.
Okay. Well, that's quite a question. Okay. the way I see it is this. Why Palestine? I would say for Christians and for Western civilization, we must not forget that our principles, our laws, our system of ethics, and our civilization is founded on Jewish laws. And I think the best that Jewish people have given us is this whole code. Whether you see, when you talk about the Abrahamic faith, okay, you know, whether you're Muslim, you're Christians, or you're Jews, basically, they are all derivatives from the Ten Commandments. And I'm talking to Christians now, okay? First half of the Ten Commandments is you shall love the Lord with all your heart and all your might. The second commandment, you love your neighbor. So first is you should worship God. Same with Muslim, same with Christian. Second one, you know, and this is like that, it's all the same. Then the other half of the Ten Commandments, you shall not steal, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife, and all that is about how you relate to your brothers and sisters. So unfortunately or fortunately, we are all brought up on the diet of Judaism. So because of that, when Israel does something, I talk for myself, when Israel does something, I just cannot square the circle. The emotional sympathy of what the Jews suffered and what they have been through during the Second World War, you can, you know, they have suffered a lot, but that doesn't translate into the victimization of the Palestinian people. It doesn't equal. A lot of people suffer doesn't mean that you can dump them on other people. The colonialists might decide to send a whole lot of Jews out of the concentration camp to kind of colonize a place called Palestine. That is a mistake of history. But then within ourselves, when we see it, then we begin to wonder, what's all this about? And then we have to come to a position that is this what civilization is about? And our civilization, in the West at least, is founded on Judaic principles. Whether you like it or not, it is. So really, you cannot escape taking a stand. And I believe that the Jews who actually examine the basis of their own ethics and philosophy will actually find out that justice is such a big component, but they dare not confront what's going on, because when it comes to your home, your future, your family, going to school and so on, you take a stand, your stuff, you're going to live in exile. Yeah, you're going to exile. So unless you're prepared to take a stand, which is a lot to ask of people, you cannot go to Haifa and say, look here, this house you're living in belongs to a Palestinian man. He built it, and now his family is living in the refugee camp of Lebanon, and they got no passport. You don't want to hear that. But you're prepared to talk about end the occupation because that affects Gaza, end the occupation because that affects West Bank. You cannot talk about the right of return because that's just a sore point, because that's a fundamental injustice to the Palestinian people. So, but we know it. Whether you like it or not, we are made in God's image. And that bit in us, which God has put into us, keep pestering us all the time and give us no peace.
My question, I just want to bring together something you said, which comes from the beginning of your story and something that came more towards the end. You mentioned in telling us how you got involved in the first place, that you came from a perspective that was very pro-Israeli. Yeah. So I would imagine that there were people in your context where you came from, relatives, friends, etc., who would be from a similar position. And then you mentioned that more recently, when you wrote about what you've seen in Gaza and the massacre that happened there, you also had a lot of interesting feedback when you shared about this. Yeah. So I just wanted to ask you, how did you deal at the beginning of this story with people's responses to what you were saying about the realities there? How do you deal with that now? And has there been any change in how you've kind of responding to this personally?
When I made a stand for Shatila camp, I make it very small because it's actually Shatila camp, Sabra and Shatila. I thought that I'm finished. I cannot be a Christian anymore, because my church preached that kind of doctrine. I will curse those that curse you and bless those that bless you, meaning that if you criticize Israel, you're finished. That's the kind of background I come from. Now, this is very strange. because that's the face of God which my church has projected to me. But when I started rediscovering what God is, rediscovering what Christianity is, I found something which is totally different, because God is not a racist. And it is possible to love the Palestinians and still remain a Christian. And it is possible to love the Palestinians and continue reading the Bible. So it was difficult because a lot of my friends in church just won't talk to me anymore. But that's a small price to pay. Now, about Gaza. Now, by that time, I'm a little bit battle-hardy. So when I wrote about Gaza with a colleague of mine, it's called The Wounds of Gaza, Lancet picked it up and published it immediately without even kind of proofreading. There's some typographical errors, and we are vilified and so on and so forth. But they kept it for 28 days on the net, which is wonderful, because my attitude is not that you took it off, but that you put it on at all. Because our job as a witness is to speak out. Whether we are hurt or we are not hurt, you still speak up. Because if you speak up and people hear about it and read about it, for 28 days, it's better than 0 days. So in that sense, I'm not only full of hope, I'm also an unreasonable optimist. So...
Thank you very much. Thank you, Sian. Finally, we're welcoming Solomuzi Mabuza from South Africa. Solomuzi, I heard speak this morning for the first time. He is a liberation theologian, a Lutheran minister, an activist, and this morning he was reflecting on apartheid in South Africa, and I know that he has made the links and is very involved in thinking about apartheid in Israel. And he's going to speak now for a few minutes again, and then the panel will question.
Good evening. I think that a testimony is not very appropriate, but it will come out. I'll say a few things, and after the doctor has spoken, I feel I shouldn't speak. Because when I speak like that, I'm told I'm radical. Desmond Tutu tells an anecdote about Africa encountering people who look like yourself. You know, when the missionary came in South Africa and different parts of Africa, as Tutu would say it, he had the Bible, and we had the land. The white men invited us to pray. We closed our eyes, and when we said, "Amen," open our eyes, they had taken our land, and we were left with this Bible. So part of our struggle is, how do we retrieve our land and continue to embrace this Bible, which is full of problems? The Bible, which also tells a lie, that God promised certain people other people's land. How can I be neutral when in 1948, when the Nakba occurred, the National Party in my country began to go about with their so-called... And you know, people who look like yourself are very intelligent. Apartheid is a good thing. Separate development. Develop yourself on your own. And that is racism, but it is given nice shape. Sometimes people who call themselves scholars do a disservice to what scholarship should be. So the lie that is told through the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, it's something that we must confront by all that we have. Tutu said, I said this in the morning, when he visited Bethlehem Israel and other parts of that troubled land years ago. You see, when a mice puts its, when an elephant puts its foot on the tail of a mice, and you look and you say, I am neutral, the mice is not going to like what you say. So the neutrality story is nonsense. It doesn't work. Palestine is the moral issue facing the world today. I think we should not forget what happened in South Africa. When I lived in Beit Sahur, one of the things that pained me was to see the energy that Palestinians, with due respect, waste in focusing in places where help is not going to come. Money does not solve everything. And I think one of the biggest things that Palestinians began to agree to when I spent my time there is that there are so many commonalities between the story of South Africa and the story of Palestine. And if solidarity is to mean anything, Palestinians need to learn about South Africa. South Africa needs to learn about Palestine, and there will be incredible solutions. Israel always partnered with South Africa officially, and I'm ashamed to say that my democratic government continues that relationship for reasons that are totally unacceptable. But people to people have not connected as they should. An average Palestinian and an average South African have not connected as deeply as they should. I felt it as an African living there. It was a painful thing. I went through so much humiliation. Tel Aviv, Amman Bridge, you know, that very notorious Allenby Bridge, etc., etc. Interrogated, pointed with M16s and all of that. That is why I'm saying I don't want to give a testimony. But Palestine is the moral issue. And we serve a God who forgives sins. So Germans must forgive themselves and move on. Europeans, North America, must grow up. One of the problems with America is that they too are practicing what Israel has done and is doing to Palestine. We are the indigenous people in America. The story goes on. So Palestinians, you need to change your strategies. There are many things I could say which are between me and the Palestinians, so I won't say them publicly. I leave my input here. Thank you.
I want to ask you a question as a Christian minister with an audience that's predominantly committed Christians. Isn't there a deep special responsibility amongst Christians in two spirits? One, that it was Christianity that persecuted the Jews in Europe in a way that culminated in the Holocaust and then triggered the support for the establishment of an Israeli state out of European guilt. And secondly, and still thriving, particularly in America, is Christian Zionism, with this perverted version of Christianity that says there has to be a Jewish state in the whole of historical Palestine before the Messiah returns, before the rapture, and then, of course, all the Jews have to go to hell if they don't convert. But this is an active movement amongst Christians in the world. And doesn't that mean there's a bigger responsibility for the Christian churches than they've taken up to seek a just resolution of this problem?
Depends how you look at or how you read history or who you read. I would disagree that Christianity persecuted the Jews. We know the ideologies that were behind the Holocaust, the Nazism and all of that. And we need to name them and shame them. it is a particular kind of interpretation of scripture that led to some of these human rights violations, to the deepest pain that Jewish people have gone through, and they should never go through it, nor put anyone through it ever again. So I'm not part of those who feel that Christianity, properly understood, is responsible for what happened to the Jews. Because Christ is the same person who on the Sabbath said, I will deliver that woman because it is important. And the Jews were saying at that time, those who were in the synagogue, the Pharisees and so forth, you can't do this on Sabbath. And he responds in a very good way. What do you do on Sabbath when your animal is stuck in the mud? So I think we need to debate quite further who actually persecuted the Jews and why. Zionism, one of my specialties is biblical hermeneutics. You see, those who write texts, those who interpret them, those who have the right to publish and control what goes to the press tend to have the last word on certain things. But who is really reading the Bible? Is it a believer or is it an unbeliever? What is his or her agenda? As I told the anecdote, as they were converting Africa, they were also pushing another agenda. But there were some good missionaries who built schools, hospitals, who cared for the human person. So we need to begin to move beyond abstract terms when we talk about the suffering of people. There is room for people who call themselves Christians for repentance, for confession. And our duty is to forgive. It is to embrace. And forgiveness, put simply in theological terms, is accepting the unacceptable. What Israel is doing to Palestine is unacceptable. What Afrikaners did to my people is unacceptable. To keep a man for 27 years, and yet he still comes out, and he doesn't put Christianity as the driving force of his change, he still embraces. But let him die, that is Nelson Mandela, you will see that even the love that he is getting as an individual will not be extended as widely as it should. So I think in our engagement, in our debates, we need to become more robust and tell the truth as it is.
Thank you. I don't know if you are aware that, in fact, the example of South Africa has been an inspiring force in the activity of many young Palestinians and activists around the world. One of the new kind of commodity, so to speak, was the apartheid week all over the campuses in the West. And it's very clear that this was a very important and significant tool in inspiring public opinion and increasing the awareness of people to what goes on in Israel and Palestine. And I think even without an academic or a political research or comparative research, people intuitively felt that they are entitled to attach the adjective apartheid to the Israeli policies or to the very nature of Israel. And I was sort of taken very deeply what you said about the need of Palestinians and South Africans to push forward mutual learning and so on. And I wondered whether you can chart in just a few words maybe some of the areas where you think that such a cooperation or such a mutual learning could benefit us all, because I think we've already exhausted the excitement, for if this is the right word, of telling people this is another South Africa. I think this is working. This is definitely working. But it's working on the level of sound bites, on the level of slogans. It is not working as a paradigm for political solution. It's not working in the way that the media here in this country analyzes what goes on in Israel and Palestine. And definitely, it is a very far cry from the way the political elite in the West views the reality on the ground. So if there's something which you can think that could push forward this kind of mutual learning, I like it much better than comparison. Comparison is for an academic word. But the mutual learning there is very, very needed, and I think should be even more specified and stressed.
I'm very glad to meet you in person.
Thank you.
I hope Same we'll here. Meet. You're doing great work. You know, as I say, let me say for an example, my grandmother is 86 years old. She doesn't read the kind of things I read. But she has wealth of experience, lived experience that is so golden, that perhaps you won't find in libraries, because even the supervisors have an agenda. So they pass a certain kind of research. And some other researchers, you one of the exceptions, would really take scholarships much more seriously. There is a need for the so-called ordinary people to meet face to face and talk the simple language over food. Because when I, as a South African, lived in Beit Sahur, I could see the things that I cannot say publicly, I must say to Palestinians, and sometimes I get an opportunity. I could see that the so-called Palestinian Authority is a sham. I could see that the so-called Oslo Peace Agreement is nonsense. The ABC compartmentalization. I could see that those leaders no longer care about the people, because they know within the space they find themselves, they will never come with a solution. So they are looting with Israel and other forces, the wealth of people in Palestine. Now, when ordinary people meet, we will tell you what happens. Because I said my own government is in partnership with Israel, and I'm very ashamed of that. But we can talk as ordinary people that, look, when you deal with power, don't just look at the skin color or who is in power, but look at the systems, look at those structures. They corrupt, and unless people who vote unite in solidarity, mobilize, things will happen. It's a shame what happened, that when the Palestinians protested openly in broad daylight and voted Hamas, not because Hamas is the best organization, but because they were sending a message that certain countries in the world did not like the outcome. And we know why. So that's why I'm saying this repentance is possible, and we can change, you know, the paradigm shift and begin to debate really as real human beings who have nothing to hide about the injustices that are visited to other people.